Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
He kōna I purangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
Hello.
Piki mai kake mai and welcome to Our Changing World. Ko Alison Balance tēnei. In the final show for 2019, we are going to think big. Science broadcaster Damien Christie is going in search of answers to a question that is much beloved of children. Where did I come from? His journey is going to take him from billions of years ago and the beginning of the universe to the last few thousand years. Damien's first port of call is theoretical astrophysicist, Associate Professor J.J. Eldridge from the University of Auckland.
Child or children? Children? Have you got one, two children?
I've got one child, yeah.
You've got one child. How old's your child?
Six.
Has your child started to ask you questions about, you know, where did I come from?
Well, there were lots of whys and hows, but I mean, we discuss this anyway because she knows I'm an astronomer and she knows my wife is a scientist. So we do kind of try and get these exciting discussions going, regardless of what biology and how that's long that's taken over billions of years to give rise to us. You've got to ask, where does the stuff that makes us come from? And we're carbon-based life forms. So where does the carbon come from? Because 13.8 billion years ago, when the universe was formed, there was only hydrogen and helium, which are these really simple elements with just very limited chemistry, and life wasn't possible because you need all these other elements, and stars make those. Normally we think, we always teach students that stars make the elements in the centre. In the centre of our sun, it's burning hydrogen to helium. In the future, it'll burn the helium to carbon and oxygen. You think, oh, that's great because we breathe oxygen, you know, and we need carbon for our proteins and our bodies. But that all gets locked away in the centre of the star and it never gets out. So there's actually this big question of how do you get the elements out of stars? And that's why we need to explode them. And that's the only way that in those explosions it can actually then get distributed and get into the universe to make planets and us.
Because we're not just made out of carbon, we are carbon-based life forms, mm-hmm. but we have other stuff inside us as well, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, off the top of my head, somebody will probably tell me I'm wrong, but we need carbon, we need nitrogen, we need oxygen, we need calcium for our bones, we need iron for the hemoglobin in our blood, and many other elements in more trace varieties, like phosphorus, I think we even need.
Let's talk about the iron, though. So the iron in our blood, where does that come from, originally?
Well, iron and iron group elements, so things like iron, nickel and cobalt, are some of the most stable elements in the universe. And stars can get energy out by fusing them in their cores all the way up to iron. But of course, that's in the centre of the star, so it never gets out. And so we need another way of trying to get these really extreme burning reactions. And the only way you can do that is to explode a star. And
I mean, this is not something we can do. I mean,
but No, we can't.
I mean,
we can try.
The evil galactic empire can do it sometimes, perhaps, but not us. But this is a process that happens naturally.
Yeah. And the even more interesting thing is we can see how iron has evolved at a different rate to other elements like oxygen in the universe, which is because they're being formed by different stars. So the iron is formed by stars like our sun if the sun was in a binary system. And
what's a binary system?
A binary system is two stars orbiting around each other. So they're locked in each other's gravity, a bit like the Earth and the Moon. You could consider them to be a binary planet because they go around each other. The difference with binary star system is that stars get bigger as they get older. And so they can actually get in each other's way and they can have these, what you can term a hectic lifestyle, because they can exchange mass. And so one can get bigger, one can get smaller, and they can even merge and become a really strange type of superstar that will have an interesting life as it evolves.
And so they get big. Sometimes, as you say, they'll absorb each other, they'll just rock around together. And then ultimately, let's get back to the iron. So how does the iron happen?
So let's go back to this binary system. We have two stars orbiting around each other. One will get old and get and die, in quotation marks, by transferring some of its material over to the other one. So the other one gets bigger, and what you have is this star called a white dwarf that's just a leftover remnant. It's that carbon and oxygen that doesn't otherwise get out of the star, and it's just sitting there, and it won't do anything else because it's not big enough to burn those elements into heavier elements. But then that companion which accreted the material, that carries on evolving, and that can actually get bigger, and that can transfer material over to the white dwarf. And that white dwarf, if it gets big enough and massive enough, about 1.5 times the mass of the sun, it collapses under its own gravity. And this is kind of interesting because lots of things do this when it gets too massive. And what happens depends on what it's made of. And because this white dwarf is made of carbon and oxygen, it collapses down and it gets to a point where the carbon ignites. So it's a bit like...
like burning coal.
A bit like burning... no. Again, because burning coal goes to chemistry.
Oh, okay.
And so that's where you get your carbon, you react it with oxygen, and so it's just the electrons doing it.
Right.
With this, because you're smashing atoms and nuclei together, you get so much more energy, millions of times more energy than you would do from a chemical reaction, which is why stars live so long, and why when this thing explodes, it can actually outshine all the stars in the galaxy for a few weeks. Which is amazing. You've got 100 or 200 billion stars in a galaxy, and yet one exploding star can be brighter than all those stars combined. Wow. And in that, all that carbon and oxygen, or most of it, gets burnt through to iron. The reaction is so intense and so extreme that you get basically almost a solar mass or mass of, sun's mass worth of iron.
So do you, for a moment, have you got an entire sort of almost like a Death Star, just to keep using the Star Wars analogy, a big sphere of iron sitting there?
No. Oh. So it's these explosions,
because that would be a lot more picturesque if that was the case.
Yeah. But you can imagine, because you like the Death Star analogy, right? Let's go back to the Death Star and we see it exploding and there's nothing left over. So most supernovae, there's always something left over in the center. But with this kind of explosion, the entire thing explodes and expands. And as it's exploding and expanding, all that carbon oxygen is getting burnt through to iron. So you've got all this iron being thrown out at high velocities, and that's where it gets mixed into the next generation of stars, and where then in the future, if we see one today, you'll get planets and life forms, hopefully in the future, using that iron.
So it's kind of more like, I don't know, a squillion ball bearings exploding, iron ball bearings
exactly.
Exploding across into space.
Yes, yeah. Microscopic, nano-sized ball bearings, yeah.
And then how does it end up inside us? I'm probably talking to the wrong person about that one, am I? I don't know.
No, I mean, so it's all this gas in the galaxy gets mixed up of all the stars dying in all the different ways, and it all gets mixed together, and eventually something, maybe they get a shock from another supernova or something, it collapses down, and it collapses down, and it keeps on collapsing down until you form at the center of this big cloud a very dense clump that's going to eventually become a star. But you also get a disk around that star, and that's where all the planets form. And depending on where the planet is and how close it is to the star, if it's quite close to the star, there'll probably be more iron and more silicon and more carbon and other things, heavier elements in the planets than if they're further out, where you've got more of the hydrogen and helium. Because it's colder, that doesn't get pushed away so much. And so you get planets like Jupiter and Saturn, which are very hydrogen and helium rich, those simple light elements. Whereas it's the terrestrial worlds like Mercury, Venus, Earth and Mars keep on to more of that heavier elements. And so, I mean, although the Earth is, I think, if I remember correctly, mostly oxygen by mass, silicon second and iron comes last. But it's still got a lot more than the other gas giant planets further out.
And that's where we come from.
And that's where we come from.
It's a bit of a jump from 4.5 billion years ago, when Earth was formed from all that gas and space dust, to the period of history covered by my next expert, a mere couple of 100,000 years ago. I first met Oxford-based archaeologist and radiocarbon dating specialist Tom Higham last year, when he was inducted as a fellow of the Royal Society Te Aparangi. In a 10-minute chat, he blew apart everything I thought I knew about where we came from, and I wanted to know more.
So ultimately, I guess your origins are in Africa. You're an African, ultimately. And we know that from many, many decades, if not centuries, of archaeological and paleoanthropological research. Charles Darwin was the first one really to write down that he felt that our ultimate origins were in Africa. And that's because the great apes, our nearest relatives on the planet Earth, that's where they live. And so he suggested that if we're going to look for our ultimate origins, then that would be the best place to first explore our origins. And ultimately that has come to pass. So there is a huge amount of fossil evidence now that has been gathered by people over the last few decades that suggests that Africa is where the earliest evidence for our own species evolves. And that takes place at around 2 to 2.5 million years ago when we find the first evidence of the genus Homo. Our anatomically modern human ancestry dates back to probably around 250 to 300,000 years ago in Africa. And again, the fossil evidence is pretty consistent with, and the dates are pretty consistent with the idea that that's where we're ultimately from. And finally, the next major piece of evidence is genetics. And we know that the genetic diversity of modern day Africans is much higher than the genetic diversity of everybody outside Africa. And that supports the idea that people outside Africa are the result of a smaller group of people leaving Africa in what we call the so-called founder effect.
That almost seems sort of, I mean, it makes sense the way you talk about it. It almost seems counterintuitive, doesn't it, that the rest of the world has a lot less diversity than one small, relatively small group.
Yeah, it's really quite, it's become much more complicated. We always used to think that a small group of humans left Africa, butted off from the African continent and left, probably at around 50 or perhaps 120,000 years ago. There's been a bit of debate about precisely which date. But we now know that there is a lot more complexity in Africa. And the idea that there was a single population that's ancestral to us is probably not true. In fact, what happened in Africa was probably that there were lots of different groups of humans living in different parts of Africa, and it's a lot more complex than we thought before. There were periods where they interacted with each other genetically and culturally, but ultimately it was the case that a smaller group of people must have left, and we think that the main options that they would have had were to leave across the Sinai, the little peninsula that links Africa to Europe, or across the straits at the very southern point of the Saudi Arabian Peninsula, the so-called Bab al-Mandab Straits. And so through one of these two ways, we think that humans moved out of Africa and into the rest of what we call the old world, into Eurasia. And the last few years have seen a tremendous increase in our understanding of when this happened. So we now have evidence just in the last few months that there must have been a much earlier exodus of humans, or early modern humans, up to about 270,000 years ago, because we have evidence for that in Greece. Some fossil remains were found in Greece. And later, we have evidence for modern humans in Israel at two very important archaeological sites that were excavated early in the 20th century. And that's about 120,000 years ago. But the main exodus, the main group of people moving out of Africa, probably was much later than that, between 50 to 60,000 years ago. And that's where we find suddenly a great diaspora of people moving into places like Australia, Southeast Asia. We think Australia was probably settled around 60 to 65,000 years ago. And there are other modern human groups that by that stage also in places like island Southeast Asia and Indonesia and so on. And there's possibly earlier modern humans that make it into China, although the evidence there is a lot more controversial.
So you're saying some of this new work has only just come out in the last couple of months. So this is really still a very much, an evolving field.
Yeah, absolutely. So the story of human evolution is really fast moving. And every few months, something else happens that just blows a hole in what we understood before or adds a great deal more to what we understood before. So, for example, it's only in the last 9 years that we've discovered another group of humans that were living in the world. We call these archaic humans because they split off from our ancestors a very long time ago. So you can imagine them as, we know Neanderthals, so you can imagine them as sort of close cousins of Neanderthals, and these are the Denisovans. So outside of Africa, when our ancestors moved into Eurasia, they interacted and met with these groups of humans that had been living outside of Africa for much longer. And these included Neanderthals in the west of Eurasia, Denisovans in the east of Eurasia, and probably other humans as well. So we had, for example, on the island of Flores in Indonesia, we had the hobbits living. So these are very small, about 1 meter high humans, Homo floresiensis. And in earlier this year, another human species was discovered in the Philippines on the island of Luzon. And so at one point in the world, there were probably around 5 or 6 different human populations that were able to interbreed with one another. And of course, many people will know that we have that genetic legacy today. So people like me, for example, who ultimately come from Europe, have around 2.5% Neanderthal DNA. And people living in Melanesia, Papua New Guinea, have the same amount of Neanderthal DNA, perhaps a little bit more, but also Denisovan DNA. And so we're finding that in different parts of the world, this genetic legacy, which is a result of our initial movement outside of Africa and our interactions with human groups that were living in Eurasia, has led to what we are today, modern humans.
I'd never heard this before, that we always assumed, didn't we, that humans had gone around, they'd killed everyone, sort of everyone else that they met, as we tend to do, and that was it. But there was actually interbreeding.
Yeah, this is the incredible thing. I mean, again, it's only in the last 10 years that this has been discovered genetically. Interestingly, there was some suggestions by physical anthropologists that some of the human remains that we find that date to, you know, around 40 to 50,000 years ago had some evidence, physical evidence, that looked as though there was a degree of partial mixing between Neanderthals and us. And this has been now demonstrated by the power of modern ancient genomics. I'll give you one really fascinating example. In 2006, I was involved in dating a human jawbone. It was found in a cave site in Romania, and it had a chin. So chins are one of the hallmark features of modern humans like us. We all have chins, even infants have little chins, whereas Neanderthals don't. So this was identified as a modern human. So a colleague of mine identified some features, however, of the jaw that looked archaic, that looked Neanderthal-like. And so he suggested that it may actually be some kind of hybrid. I must say I was really skeptical at the time. But DNA evidence was obtained a couple of years ago, which suggested that the physical anthropology was absolutely spot on. Not only was there evidence for Neanderthal DNA in the specimen, but it was present in such large chunks that that must only mean that there was a very recent ancestor, a Neanderthal ancestor, in the life of this particular individual. And so we were able to say that this person had a Neanderthal great-great-grandfather. So 4 to 6 generations before this person lived, or thereabouts, there was a Neanderthal ancestor. And so we were able to put actual generation times on the interaction between different human groups, whereas before we just simply couldn't do that. So the power of ancient DNA is really helping us to understand how it was that our groups met one another 50 to 60,000 years ago.
And so when we've got this interbreeding going on, did we pick up characteristics? Do we still have characteristics that we can point to and say, this is from Neanderthal, this is from these other groups?
Yeah, we do. And this is one of the most exciting things at the moment, is to figure out what we got from Neanderthals and Denisovans and perhaps other groups that we are yet to discover, and what was positive and what was negative. So we already know that there were some positive things. So, for example, we know that aspects of our skin quality and our collagen and our hair actually comes from Neanderthals. And Neanderthals were living in very cool conditions, very icy conditions for the most part in Europe for the previous 300 to 400,000 years. And so they had time to adapt and to cope with these kind of conditions. And it may be that when we interbred with them, those were some of the things that we then selectively used in our own genomes. In the case of the Denisovans, there's some fascinating evidence that suggests that DNA from Denisovans was at the heart of the adaptation of people to living at high altitudes. If you look at, for example, people from Tibet, they have a gene that allows them to survive at high altitude. It's called EPAS1, and it's a hypoxic gene. So it means that you can cope with very low levels of oxygen in your blood supply and then have children at high altitude. And this gene was a complete mystery as to where it came from. Did it evolve in humans? Did people have to live at altitude before they evolved this particular adaptation? Well, the answer is that that DNA, that gene, is found in Denisovans, and it must have come from them, integrated into modern humans, and given us this amazing advantage. And earlier on this year, a human bone was found in a cave in the Tibetan plateau, which was identified as Denisovan and dated to about 160,000 years ago, putting these people in that area of the Tibetan plateau. And it may be that this is where that that adaptation occurred.
That is really fascinating. Now, one last thing. When we were talking about diabetes, because I understand the diabetes gene comes from Neanderthals. And I said, so does that mean they don't have diabetes in Africa? Did you find the answer to that?
So that is a really interesting question. God, I wish I knew the answer from my head. I've forgotten about that. Maybe it was
That's all right. I'm going to leave you with that as some homework, and you can come back to me on
that
one.
I'm going to have to go and look into that. There's always another question that arises. That's the great thing about science.
While we wait for Tom to get back to us about my diabetes question, which I'm quietly hoping might alter the course of evolutionary science as we know it, I thought I'd bring our main query, where do I come from, back home to Aotearoa, and to Otago University molecular anthropologist Lisa Mutisu-Smith, who has herself had huge influence answering this curly question. Lisa, hi.
Hi.
Answer however you want. Where did I come from?
Where did I come from? Or where did you come from? That's the question I often fear, because it clearly matters to people. But there are so many answers to that question at so many different levels. I have an American accent. That's usually what people are, where are you from? You know, wanting to place you. And that whole concept of wanting to place somebody, I think, is a human need. If you think about, a pepeha, when you meet somebody and, hi, who are you? Where are you from? People want to kind of conceptually place you. So the accent is something that obviously people pick up when I speak here in Aotearoa. And so where are you from? Oh, I'm from Dunedin. And you can see by the look on their face, no, that's not what I wanted to, that didn't give me the right answer. And it's like, oh, well, I have an American accent. Yes, I was born in Hawaii.
That reminds me of a friend of mine who's Chinese. To look at her, and my grandmother said to her once when she was at my graduation, she said, oh, and where are you from? And she said, Tauranga.
Yeah,
My grandmother gave her a look like, no,
not
the
right answer. And that's, I think that's the thing. Where are you from? There's no single answer. Where are we from? Where are we as a species from? Where is Homo sapiens from? Yes, ultimately we all come from Africa. But, it really depends on the context.
Let's talk, though, about the, one of the pieces of work that you're renowned for, which is actually relating to the tangata whenua. And where did, how did people get here? How did the first people get here? And you, tell me about the work that you did with the DNA there.
Yeah. So, I guess there's a how and from where. Those two questions kind of go together. So I'm a biological anthropologist. But I am an anthropologist by training. I use biological tools to understand human origins and the work we've been doing on the settlement of Aotearoa and the Pacific ties back to that where do we come from question, where, what is the Hawaiki? And again, it's the same issue of how far back do you want to go? So we can talk about where is Hawaiki, from the stories. It is a mythological place, but we have been able to identify through the DNA of not only Maori people, but also the plants and animals that that Pacific peoples carried in their waka. As they settled the Pacific, we can use those as markers to track the movement of the waka and therefore the movement of the people.
Can you give me an example of that?
So I started my work looking at Radis excellens, DNA, and Radis excellens is known as Kiore in Polynesia.
It's a rat.
It is a different species from the European rats, Radis raticus and Radis norvegicus, so it does not interbreed with those other species.
Radis raticus.
Yes, and Radis norvegicus.
That's the Norwegian rat and the ship rat?
Yeah, yep. So they, the Kiore, or Radis excellens, doesn't travel on European boats. It has completely different kind of behavioral characteristics. It doesn't like to get its feet wet. And it was transported in the waka intentionally. It was an important food item as well as a taonga. It had a lot of cultural significance. And in the same way that the British brought gorse and all kinds of things with them when they came here, Pacific peoples carried the plants and animals that were of cultural significance to them. So the kiore is one of those taonga. And I studied the DNA of the kiore from around New Zealand and was able to track them back through the Pacific to the origin of the kiore. So we could trace the kiore that were still living here on the islands, and the kiore living here are the direct descendants of those that were introduced by the first colonists. So we found out where they were coming from, and they were coming from the Cook Islands and the Society Islands. So Rarotonga, Raiatea, Tahiti, that group of islands. So we've identified the Hawaiki, and it's not a particular place, but a homeland region that is the homeland for really all of East Polynesia. It's a homeland for Hawaii as well, and it's the homeland for Rapa Nui as well as Aotearoa. So there's a central East Polynesian homeland.
Does the kiore live, is there a step before Polynesia? Yep. Does the kiore live in Taiwan?
So that's the next. So we go, okay, so we can trace the kiore from Aotearoa back to Hawaiki of the societies and the Cooks. We can trace those back to West Polynesia. We can trace those kiore back to island Southeast Asia. Interestingly, they do not trace back to Taiwan. They're not native to Taiwan. So while the languages, the Austronesian languages, which all Polynesians speak and a large percentage of Pacific people speak, can be traced back to Taiwan. And many people hear about the Taiwan origins for Maori or for Polynesians. That's only the linguistic data. So we can also start to look at the archaeological data, and we can look at the genetic data, and that's what we're doing now. We've moved from looking at the kiore and the kuri, the dog, to looking at human DNA in collaboration with indigenous communities here and across the Pacific.
You're talking about sort of multifaceted ways of where did we come from. There is the DNA, which seems like the most sciencey way of looking at something, I suppose, in a way, right? And but then there's, you know, as you say, architecture. There's stories. There's language. So how do you weave all these together to build a picture?
That's the thing that's the most interesting and exciting for me, is that we as humans are complex, and we have complex cultures, and we make choices. We have some control over the choices that we make.
There's some building going on,
and creaky floors upstairs. Busy place. But I think it's the richness of what makes us human. And so while your DNA tells part of your story, it's not your whole story. And as you talk about, you know, your mother and her twin brother have different DNA. You know, it's not just our DNA who makes us who we are. And so our history is similarly complex. So, you know, I can be sitting here in Aotearoa with an American accent and Estonian genes. You know, it's complex, and you've got to understand that complexity and celebrate that complexity. That's what I love, is that that, you know, we can celebrate our common origins and our unity and our diversity, and appreciate that. And the more we can talk about these things, and that it's not a black and white issue, that it's this very, very rich tapestry. And it's, I always say, it's like a tuku-tuku panel. You're weaving together all of these lines of evidence, all of these, and it ultimately tells that pattern that you see, tells a story, and that's the human story, and that's what is biological. Well, that's what anthropology, and that's what I love.
And that's where we come from.
That's where we come from.
Thanks, Lisa. That was Lisa Matisu-Smith from the University of Otago. We also heard from Tim Higham from the University of Oxford and JJ Eldridge from the University of Auckland. And that story was produced for us by Damien Christie from the Aotearoa Science Agency. And that's Our Changing World for another year. I'll be back on the 23rd of January 2020 with a brand new season. But never fear, there is summer science to keep you company over the summer break. We will be beaming from your radio or your favourite digital device each evening, just after the 7 o'clock news on Mondays, Wednesdays and Fridays. Catch you then. In the meantime, you can listen to tonight's story again at our webpage, rnz.co.nz/ourchangingworld. While you're there, why not stock up on some stories from our audio archive to keep you company over the summer break? You could relive the epic kakapo breeding season with the Kakapo Files, indulge in a marathon session of chemical elements with Elemental, or peruse the ever-eclectic lineup of Our Changing World stories. You'll also find everything I've just mentioned on your favourite podcast app. Thanks for your company. Have a great summer break. Until next year, it's good night from me, Alison Balance. Paul Marie.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavourless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.